Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. The Trump administration has babies on the brain. Here is President Trump, the father of five, talking about how to fix the declining birth rate.
And we will support baby bonuses for a new baby boom. How does that sound? That sounds pretty good. I want a baby boom.
Vice President J.D. Vance, during a speech at the March for Life in Washington in January, framed it as a moral duty.
Our society has failed to recognize the obligation that one generation has to another is a core part of living in a society to begin with. So let me say very simply, I want more babies in the United States of America.
Leaders of the pronatalism movement in April presented the Trump administration with a list of ideas for boosting the birth rate. The president is weighing everything from a $5,000 baby bonus to a motherhood medal to offering classes to help women track their most fertile times. Joining us now is Carter Sherman, a reproductive health and justice reporter at The Guardian. She's been covering the issue. She's also the author of a forthcoming book, The Second Coming, Sex and the Next Generation's Fight Over Its Future. Welcome to All Sides, Carter.
Thank you for having me.
So top administration officials are concerned that America's birth rate has fallen below the rate of replacement, which is about 2.1 children per couple. Now, given the concerns about overpopulation and a warming planet, why do they believe that the declining birth rate is such a bad problem for society?
Well, the fear is that the declining birth rate will lead to a shrinking and aging workforce. And as employees get older, as we have fewer of them, there's going to not be enough younger employees who can sustain that older workforce. Now, people say that you could also, for example, expand that workforce by increasing immigration, but we would have to see a really different posture from the Trump administration on immigration for that to be possible.
Now, you write that pronatalism is a contentious issue, and people often struggle to even agree on a definition of it. What is pronatalism? How do you define it?
Well, I think a lot of people define it a lot of different ways, but for the purposes of the discussion that is going on right now in U.S. politics, I think the most useful definition is that pronatalism is the belief that having babies is important for the greater good, that the state should incentivize people to have more babies, and that specifically that incentive should happen because of the declining birth rate.
Now, who has coalesced around the pronatalism movement? Is it mainly, is it the Republican Party, or is it what types of people do we see? Because there are some parts of pronatalism that people on the left may agree with.
It's certainly a right-wing ideology right now and historically in U.S. politics. I really see pronatalism as being a key plank in the bridge between the more traditional family values conservatives and the emerging tech right, which is exemplified by people like Elon Musk, who was probably at this point the most famous pronatalist on the planet. He reportedly has 14 of his own children. And this ideology is helping those people come together around the idea that we should have bigger families, that more people should be having more children. And in particular, I think there is, for the family values folks, a belief that families should look a specific way, that marriage should be between man and a woman, and that there should be some, frankly, pretty traditional gender roles at work here.
Yeah, there's the modern face of the pronatalism movement is a Pennsylvania couple. They're everywhere if you Google this. Simone and Malcolm Collins. Can you tell us about them and the influence they're having on the Trump administration?
Yeah, Simone and Malcolm Collins get profiled a lot. I think they have a very distinctive look, which adds to their media appeal. They both have particular glasses that they wear all the time, if you want to Google them. They are members of the tech right side of things, and they've been very open in particular about their use of IVF to have more kids. I believe they have at least four children right now. The most recent reports I saw was that Simone was pregnant with their fifth. And the thing that is particularly controversial about the Collins is oftentimes that use of IVF. IVF is really one of the cracks in that bridge that I was mentioning earlier, because many of the traditional family values conservatives have a lot of concerns about IVF. They think that because they oftentimes have beliefs about abortion and abortion being wrong, they think that embryos are people and that IVF as it's currently practiced is an issue for them because it can often lead to the destruction or abandonment of embryos. Now, the tech right sometimes sees IVF as a way to build quote unquote better babies, which then raises in turn concerns about eugenics.
The Collins family is interesting, though, because when you Google them, I did yesterday, you find a lot of stories about them. And then you also find one story near the top that says, stop profiling these people. So with that made me laugh. But anyway,
well, I don't know that they are the exact avatar of the pronatalism movement in this country right now. I think a lot of people would describe themselves as pronatalists from a lot of different backgrounds. But again, because they're so distinctive looking and because they're willing to say kind of outrageous things, this makes them catnip for reporters.
Now, the Trump administration has floated many ideas on how to increase the birth rate, from offering a $5,000 baby bonus to a motherhood medal for women who have at least six children, to a Fulbright scholarship incentive as well. You also wrote about the Department of Transportation. They issued a memo in January. What does the Department of Transportation have to do with the birth rate?
Well, the Department of Transportation memo specifies that department resources should be prioritized in going towards areas that have birth rates and marriage rates that are higher than the national average. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about that is that Republicans tend to have higher birth and marriage rates than Democrats do. So in practice, this would end up devoting more department resources towards Republican areas, which are, of course, President Trump's voting base. Mm.
Now, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, during a recent speech in New York, she said that Vice President J.D. Vance and Elon Musk are pushing to boost America's birth rate to, quote, return to being a Christian nation. So she criticized the Trump administration for gutting programs that could actually help more new parents in a different way. And they're deporting immigrants, and immigrants are a way to increase the population, and immigrants are having babies. What did you make of Hillary Clinton's comments?
I think that this is a sentiment that's shared by a lot of people. A lot of skeptics of pronatalism see it as a push towards Christian nationalism, that pronatalists don't want everybody to be having more babies. They want specific people to be having more babies. And they point to the Trump administration's opposition to immigration as evidence of that. I think the other thing that people bring up a lot that Hillary Clinton's comments seem to reflect is that it is uniquely difficult to be a parent in the United States. The United States is the only rich country on the planet that does not have any form of federal paid leave. It is more expensive here to give birth. We do not invest nearly as much money into subsidized childcare as other wealthy countries do. And so I think a lot of people are pretty frustrated with the idea that we would push to increase the birth rate without actually making it easier for parents to live their lives and raise those children.
Now, the Trump administration hasn't taken any official action. What can he actually do? Does he need Congress to act, or can he do executive orders related to the birth rate?
I mean, he can try a lot of things. We'll see what actually works out. And I think that this is something I've been thinking a lot about, which is that on one hand, the Republicans have made a commitment to majorly slashing the budget, but these pronatalist policies, quite a few of them, cost a lot of money. And so I don't know how many of them are actually going to end up being implemented. We might see more low-cost proposals being implemented, such as the medal for motherhood could be something that we might see emerge, but I don't know that I really think that the Republicans are going to be able to do something like $5,000 baby bonuses, because it doesn't seem compatible with their vision for the budget.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the Trump administration's push to increase the birth rate in the U.S. with Carter Sherman, a reproductive health and justice reporter at The Guardian. Now, historically, looking back beyond just the past few months, when have pronatalist movements gained steam and why?
In the United States, pronatalism seems to surge whenever there are times of demographic anxiety. So, in the United States in particular, we saw a great increase in pronatalism during the late 19th and early 20th century. This was a time when the United States was seeing increased immigration. We were also seeing a push by women for women's greater presence in public life. Women at the time were agitating for the right to vote, which, of course, they got. President Theodore Roosevelt even talked at the time about quote unquote race suicide, by which he was referring to white women going to college and thereby delaying having families. So this really brings back these concerns about pronatalists not being interested in everybody having babies, but the quote unquote right people having babies, which is to say white people.
Yeah, and then also eugenics has come into play here. We mentioned the Collinses before. The Collinses screen for IQ. Now, scientists are not convinced that that's necessarily possible in embryos, but it's talked about. So can't, you know, that goes to not just the right people having babies, but also the right kind of babies.
Right. And the Collinses would say that they're not practicing eugenics per se because the only bloodlines they're altering are their own, although they have joked about them being identified as hipster eugenicists. That is the concern. And I think this concern also goes back to the history of pronatalism in the United States. Around the same time that pronatalism surged in that late 19th century, early 20th century, we did also see a concurrent rise in interest in eugenics and in sterilizing people who were thought to be, quote unquote, undesirable.
Now, I've seen references, you know, when the Trump administration brought out these ideas. At least among the general public and women, the social media reaction was swift, it was quick. And I've seen lots of references to The Handmaid's Tale, the 1985 novel, and there's also the TV show that's out right now with a new season. And I read an interview from a few years ago with Margaret Atwood, the author of the book, and she said that she drew inspiration from real-world events and historical precedents. Have you been reading a lot about like some Handmaid's Tales ideas happening with some of these ideas.
People have brought up The Handmaid's Tale to me quite a bit. You know, I cover abortion rights more generally, and so Handmaid's Tale references are rife in those circles. I think that in general, the US populace is not really bought into the idea of pronatalism, in part because of how difficult it is to be a parent and the frustrations that people have with pronatalism because of that. But I did talk to one young woman who was afraid that because people are not necessarily interested in pronatalism on their own, the government would force people into a Handmaid's Tale-like situation and into having people have more babies. And I think that it's not a fear that can be assuaged at this time. I think we're going to have to see how things fall out over the next few years.
You also interviewed Elizabeth Gregory, who directs the women's gender and sexuality studies at the University of Houston, and she commented about how childbearing takes a toll on women's futures and how that seems to get lost in all of these conversations. Have you heard a lot about that? About how you mentioned that having children is hard in the United States.
Oh, absolutely. People have talked about this. I mean, having children, raising children, those are not cost-free propositions, right? Somebody has to be doing those things. And women, oftentimes biologically or socially, are pushed into those roles. And because, in part, the enormous cost of childcare in this country, this can oftentimes lead to women being forced back into the home and out of the workforce. And so I think there are real questions about what an increase in births and pushing people to have more children would mean for the rights of women and the advancement of women.
Now, just to end on, South Korea has the world's lowest birth rate, and politicians there called it a national emergency. But they also have what's called the 4B movement, which is women deciding not to date, marry, or have sex or have babies in protest over the male patriarchy. Do you see maybe is parts of the Trump administration looking to South Korea and they're worried about that happening?
Actually, the United States is already in the middle of what is known here as a sex recession. Young Americans are having sex later and less. This is part of what I get into in my book. And after Trump won in November, there was a surge of interest on social media in the 4B movement. Now, I don't necessarily think we're going to see a lasting sex strike here in the US, but I think this does speak to growing concerns about the direction of relationships between men and women. And in particular, are men, by virtue of going more right, going to be pushing women who are going more left back into the past? You know, I think South Korea is also an interesting example because they did recently raise their birth rate slightly, but in general, pronatalist policies, we don't really know what works. You know, a lot of other countries are dealing with declining birth rates, both more right-leaning countries like Hungary and more left-leaning countries like Finland, and those kinds of countries have adopted all kinds of pronatalist policies. But in general, birth rates are falling in industrialized countries. And the fact may be that when people have more choices about how to live their lives because they have more money, they might just make the choice not to have kids.
That was Carter Sherman, a reproductive health and justice reporter at The Guardian. Also has a book coming out soon, The Second Coming, Sex and the Next Generation's Fight Over Its Future. Carter, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk with an Ohio State sociology professor who directs the university's Institute for Population Research. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The president and vice president are urging Americans to have more babies. They propose some ideas taken from the pronatalism movement. A $5,000 benefit, a motherhood medal for women who give birth to more than six children. But should the government be enticing Americans to have more babies? Will it work? Those of childbearing age cite a number of reasons why they are waiting to have a family. Money worries, inadequate housing, environmental concerns, and a generational shift in priorities. Birth rates, attitudes about parenthood, overall population trends. Our next guest studies them all. Sarah Hayford is a sociology professor at Ohio State University, where she directs the Institute for Population Research. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Hayford.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you've been studying this issue for quite a while now. Are you concerned about a declining birth rate in the U.S.?
No, I'm not concerned about a declining birth rate in the U.S. I'm interested in understanding the declining birth rate, but I don't think there's anything intrinsically good or bad about low birth rates or high birth rates.
Okay, well, what about Ohio? Are you at all concerned about Ohio's birth rate being different than the rest of the U.S.?
You know, Ohio's birth rate is a little lower than the U.S. in part because our population is older. But in terms of trends, Ohio's trends look pretty much like trends in the United States as a whole. So, you know, as in many things, Ohio is kind of a national average in birth rates.
Okay. And the birth rate may be declining, but what does the overall population picture look like for the U.S.?
Well, the overall population in the U.S. is still growing. It's growing less fast than it was growing 10 years ago or 20 years ago. But the population is still getting bigger. That's partly because of immigration. But even the native-born population in the United States is still growing slowly.
Mm. Now, what about toward the world? Are there any markers around the world that tell a different story? Or is the population of the entire world going down?
Nope, the world's population is also still growing. It's growing more slowly than it was growing. And there are a lot of countries individually whose population is beginning to shrink. But there's still a lot of parts in the world where birth rates are quite high. Overall, the world's population is getting bigger. So there's no reason to worry about the human population going extinct, at least not in the future that we can project and, you know, in the next several hundred years.
I read that in the Washington Post, I read that by 2100, only six countries will have fertility rates above the replacement rate. And they're like Somalia, Chad, Tonga. Does that worry you if you're looking at trends, you know, 100 years from now?
I think it's really hard to predict trends 100 years from now. I mean, we're pretty good demographers at predicting trends for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. But any prediction that we have, you know, for 2100 assumes that things are going to stay the same for the next 75 years. And that's probably not the case. We don't know how things will change, but they'll probably change somehow.
Now, as someone who directs the Institute for Population Research, were you surprised when you heard of this movement from the president and the vice president urging Americans to have more babies? Did that surprise you?
It surprised me a little bit to see them pick up the particular ideas that they're picking up. But certainly in American history, there's a long history of people being worried about birth rates, either birth rates being too low, birth rates being too high, the wrong people having children or having children at the wrong times. So this is an ongoing concern, and it's been a growing concern over the past 10 years as birth rates in the United States have started to fall. So it's not particularly surprising that it should be growing in prominence and visibility, this movement.
Now, I mean, there's a lot of talk about how Americans are, and Ohioans for that matter, are all getting older, and there's not as many people to take care of them because there's more boomers than there are people coming up to take care of them. So don't you think that that applies into this whole idea of people having more children so that we don't continue to have this problem? You know, someday someone will need to take care of Gen Z when they're 80.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I'm worried about there are, you know, aging populations and our younger populations being well taken care of. If you think about that as a concern, there's lots of ways of addressing that concern. So you could increase immigration rates. You could change the way that care for older people or care for younger people is organized. You could increase salaries for people working in retirement communities. So there's lots of ways of thinking about how do we make sure vulnerable people in our population are well taken care of. I mean, if you think about birth rates, you know, the children that we have now will be in the workforce in 20 years or 30 years. So they're not really a solution to our short-term problems. We need to think about other kinds of policies to address these problems in the near term and in the long term.
Now, the administration has proposed some ideas that are taken from what's called the pronatalism movement. One of them is a $5,000 benefit for having a baby. Another one is a motherhood medal to give for women who give birth to more than six children. What do you think of those types of ideas?
You know, I think if we think about like a $5,000 baby benefit, you know, obviously it would be nice. It's nicer to have $5,000 than not to have $5,000. So that's a nice benefit. But when you think about what having a child costs, I mean, if you think about the costs of medical care during pregnancy and delivery, you know, $5,000 doesn't even go very far to covering those immediate short-term costs. If you think longer about buying diapers, if you think about buying baby furniture, if you think about education, if you think about childcare, $5,000 just doesn't really address those really substantial costs of parenting in the United States. Other countries have tried this kind of baby bonus. It sometimes has a sort of short-term effect. If people have been thinking about maybe I'll have a child in the next year or two, they might think, okay, well, maybe I'll speed that up. But it doesn't really have a longer-term impact in increasing birth rates.
Now, I don't know if you've studied this in particular or how exactly to study this, but how helpful is it for the government to get involved in family decisions? Like, does it work? Can the government make families have more babies?
There's never been a successful policy that worked for a long term at increasing birth rates in a substantial way. I mean, even sort of, you know, you can think of policies that provide incentives to have children or policies that make it easier for parents to raise children. And you can think of also policies that work kind of in the opposite direction, negative incentives against not having children or preventing people from controlling their childbearing, you know, making contraception hard to access or abortion hard to access. And none of these policies, either the positive policies or maybe the more punitive policies, have really had sustained impacts on birth rates. It's such a personal decision and such an impactful decision for people and families to have children that there's not much governments can do to really have a big influence on those decisions.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Sarah Hayford, a sociology professor at Ohio State University, where she directs the Institute for Population Research. I read in an article from 2022 in The Atlantic, you were quoted in it, you mentioned how it's become more acceptable now in society to not want to be a parent. That wasn't always the case. It used to be the expectation was you get married, you have children. What do you think changed there?
I think one of the things that changed is that people had different kinds of opportunities, and especially women had different kinds of opportunities. And as women had different opportunities available to them, to go to school, to go to work, to have roles and responsibilities that weren't only about their family roles and responsibilities, that just made it possible for people to organize their lives in different ways and have sort of fulfilling and socially connected and engaging lives without being parents. I think another thing that's maybe happened is that people are thinking differently about parenting and what it means to be a good parent. And as people are really focusing on emotionally connecting with their children, spending quality time with their children, being engaged with their children, that's something that people want to think more carefully about taking on and feel more prepared to take on. And so it feels more acceptable to say, I'm not ready for that, or I don't think I'd be good at that, or that's not the kind of life I want to choose for myself.
In a 2023 study that you did with other researchers, you wanted to learn how young people, and we're talking like ages 20 to 24, think about parenthood. This wasn't simply asking, did they want to be parents or not? Why did you feel like it was important to zero in on this age group and ask them about being parents?
We were really interested in that 20 to 24 age group because that's an age where people are making a lot of decisions about the rest of their lives. People are making decisions about college and higher education. They're making employment decisions. They're, you know, getting into romantic relationships and forming long-term partnerships. And we really wanted to understand how people were thinking about parenthood as part of those other decisions and as connected to those other decisions before they actually became parents. So how were they thinking about how they wanted their life to unfold, and where did parenting fit into that?
Did they want to be parents, or did you ask that question?
Most of them did want to be parents, actually. I mean, nobody wanted to be a parent right away, but most of them did want to have children eventually.
Right. And because I mean, it used to be that a lot of people just, you know, thought that they needed to have children before 30, but now it's becoming more like, oh, well, we need to do it before 40, right? That kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. And there's still some people who, you know, who want to be young parents, who are sort of want to have a lot of energy and be able to run around with their kids and want to have children earlier. But a lot of people want to make sure they're really financially prepared to have children and emotionally prepared to have children.
Have you also studied the number of children people have? Do more people nowadays have only one or two kids as opposed to four?
You know, a lot of people still have two or three kids. It is more common to have only one child, but that's still pretty rare in the United States.
Now, there are fewer teen pregnancies, which is a positive development, but also does that contribute to the decrease in population, that we have more awareness of this idea of, and we have as a country reduced the number of teen pregnancies over time?
It's really one of the big drivers of falling birth rates in the United States. So birth rates are declining among teenagers and people in their early 20s. Birth rates are actually rising among women in their 30s and 40s. So a lot of what's happening is people are delaying having children. And we may very well see a sort of plateau or even maybe an increase in birth rates as that sort of shifting schedule settles out. And we see, you know, what's going to happen to the people who are in their 20s now and how many children will they have in their 30s.
And are there also, have you studied ethical concerns over kind of like modern day eugenics, or using technology to genetically select qualities in children? Because there is talk with this whole idea of rewarding people for having more children, but what if you end up rewarding particular types of people for having more children?
I think that's one of the big concerns about some of the movements that are more aggressively pushing people to have children, is who they're pushing to have children, how they're thinking about those decisions and who's benefiting from those decisions. It's still very expensive. You know, it's possible to do some selection of embryos, but it's very expensive to do that. It's sort of time consuming and invasive to do that. So that's not something that's a really common behavior across most of the population at this point.
Now, I wanted to talk about maybe another country just to use an example. Like, what does work when it comes to increasing birth rates? Because other countries have tried to do this. Hungary tried and they didn't see much success. What did they try to do?
I'm not familiar with the Hungarian policy specifically. I think they did try to do some cash baby bonuses. Mm-hmm. I mean, some other policies that people often think about when they think about efforts to stabilize growth, population growth rates, you might look to like Scandinavian countries that have very well-developed social welfare programs, providing childcare, providing parental leave, providing unemployment insurance, providing health insurance for everybody. And those have not necessarily worked to increase the birth rates. They do work to help families raise children and to sort of help children be healthier and reduce child poverty. So they do seem to make experiences better for the families that do have children.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because this idea of the pronatalism movement and giving a $5,000 bonus, giving a medal to a woman who, if she has more than six kids, that really doesn't equate to paid family leave or making the cost of daycare more affordable or being able to have a household where two parents work instead of one staying home. Do you see that in other countries? Like, is that what you're talking about, basically, that having all those policies doesn't even necessarily mean more children are around?
Right, exactly. I mean, having, you know, those policies might or might not work as pronatalist policies. They do work as pro-family policies and pro-child policies.
So you're saying they benefit people who already have children, but they're not going to necessarily, I mean, wouldn't they help people think about having more children or maybe children sooner? Because you mentioned the money piece there where they're waiting until they're more economically stable. If daycare didn't cost $2,000 a month, you wouldn't need to be as economically stable, right?
Exactly. I think it would make it easier for people to think about having children and to really think about their relationship with their child and their personal preferences rather than these financial demands.
So in the next segment, we're going to talk with an official from the Institute for Family Studies, which supports the pronatalist movement. What's your takeaway on these positions on how to increase not only the birth rate in the U.S., but they're also pushing for more marriage in general?
I think it's very complicated when the government starts to intervene in personal decisions about family relationships. I think that, you know, when people are making the decision to get married or to have children, they're making an individual decision based on their specific situation and their relationships and the partner they're thinking about marrying. And so I think at some level, we have to trust that people can make good decisions about those things. Certainly, there's a lot of room for the government to support families, you know, financially, support with healthcare, support with childcare. But I think that focusing on the sort of relationship outcomes rather than the supports and making things easier for people has the potential to be coercive, and that sometimes can be a little concerning.
That was Sarah Hayford, a sociology professor at Ohio State University. She directs the Institute for Population Research. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much, Amy.
And coming up, as I said, we're talking to the Institute for Family Studies about their ideas for strengthening the family unit and growing larger families in the future. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
Support for WOSU comes from court-appointed special advocates of Franklin County. CASA Volunteer Guardians provide a consistent voice for abused and neglected children in Franklin County Juvenile Court. CASA's next hybrid training class for new volunteers begins June 29th. Learn more at franklincountyohio.gov/CASA.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking this hour about the declining birth rates in the U.S. and ideas the Trump administration is considering to reverse that trend. Among the pronatalist proposals on the table, a $5,000 baby bonus, a motherhood medal for women who give birth to at least six children. But should the government be incentivizing Americans to have more babies? Will it work? Joining us now is Chris Bullivant, Director of Communications for the Institute for Family Studies, which promotes pronatalism through its Pronatalism Initiative. Welcome to All Sides, Chris.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for having us on the show.
Now, our previous guest was a sociology professor at Ohio State. She runs Ohio State's Institute for Population Research. And when I asked her if she was concerned about the declining birth rate, she said she wasn't. So why are some people sounding an alarm about declining birth rates and others are not?
Well, there is actually globally a decline in birth rates. And from about 2010 onwards, we began to see a big decline globally. So it's not just the United States, it is other Western European countries, but it's also developing countries and middle-income countries that are seeing a decline. That decline started in the US in about 2007, where back then families, well, on average, women were having 2.1 children. That was the total fertility rate. But now that 2.1 has dropped down to 1.6. That is below the replacement rate. So that's been quite a rapid decline. And America seems to have led the way on that decline.
Now, the Sarah Hayford, who we had in the last segment, said that she was not worried about the birth rate being below 2.1. She didn't feel like the replacement rate was needed. Basically, she was saying there's plenty of people in the world. What would you say to that? Does it need to be a one-for-one replacement rate?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that's a good question. I mean, it does have a knock-on on things like Social Security or Medicaid, where those checks won't clear, although I think that's already on the books anyway. But yeah, I mean, surely perhaps it's good for the environment if there are fewer people. There are sort of, these are all totally reasonable questions to ask. I think what we've noticed on the studies that we do, and at the Institute for Family Studies, we're similarly based in sociology and social science, and we look at big data and big survey trends. I say that really as a health warning, that some of what we then communicate doesn't come with a sort of like pastorally sensitive message, perhaps, because there's always unique stories. Life is complicated. There's always sort of an exception to the rule. And so I think I just want to put that out there first. So when we talk about things, we are talking about the big data. It turns out that I think when we look at that, most women apparently want to be able to have 2.2 or 2.7 children on average. So I think some of our sort of question is, well, why, if people want to have 2.2 to 2.7 children, why are they only having 1.6? So I think that is some of sort of where we are coming from. It's like if people have an aspiration to be able to have families, what's stopping them having the families? And so I think that's when that's our approach when we're looking at the different policy solutions, and when the Trump administration are putting suggestions forward, we're thinking about it from that perspective, like how is this helping empower people to fulfill their aspirations for the size of family that they are wanting?
Elon Musk has emerged as the world's most famous cheerleader for bigger families. The Wall Street Journal put the number of children that he has at least 14. Some made the traditional way, others by in vitro fertilization. He talked to Fox News, and he had a dire prediction. Let's listen.
The birth rate is very low in almost every country. Unless that changes, civilization will disappear. America had the lowest birth rate, I believe, ever. That was last year. Places like Korea, the birth rate is one-third replacement rate. So that means in three generations, Korea will be 3 or 4% of its current size. And nothing seems to be turning that around. Humanity is dying.
Now, humanity is dying. That's a pretty bleak assessment. Do you share that much of a dramatic assessment of it?
I mean, he's definitely been very helpful putting this on the map in terms of the national conversation. I think when people talk about 2.1 or 1.6, it's a little bit, obviously, it's a little bit hard to figure out what does that mean when one in two-thirds of a child walking around with a family. Mm-hmm. But actually what it does come to mean that is, yeah, with every generation, which we can look at as 30%, every 30 years rather, the American population at the current weight shrinks by a quarter. So that means, Amy, like your children, when they have grown up, and they had their own, the population that their grandkids in is going to be, you know, quite a lot smaller than ours currently. So I think that's That is definitely sort of surprising. And I know that the previous guest also wasn't totally sure if I'd heard correctly that a delay in having children has that much of an impact that maybe the birth rates will rise. But actually, I think what the studies that we have looked at and the sweep of demographics suggest that actually people getting married later, people having children later, does actually have an overall impact on the number of children that they have and that people overall have. I think where we would differ on Elon Musk's approach is that I think he's right to bring some, you know, level of concern to this, that this is a very big development demographically. It does have a big sort of knock on down the road and also in the very immediate. But I think his approach is perhaps from, again, the exceptions breaking the rule. His may not be the model to follow. I know that he's, you know, having lots of children through lots of different women. But actually, it does mean that their own, actually, it turns out their fertility rate is probably lower than they would be if they were actually just with one person. The biggest single driver that we have found that keeps the fertility rate low is actually the decline in marriage, which is sort of surprising, I think. But what we've noticed is that amongst the top 25% by income of Americans, marriage rates are pretty much the same. They've stayed stable, and the fertility rate has stayed the same. So above that national average. So there's a replacement rate happening there. So it may be that for many of your listeners, they're thinking, well, what is this even about? We've got 2.5 kids. We've got, you know, as everyone else that we know. But for those who are in the 75th percentile and below on income, marriage rates have just fallen through the roof. And actually most of the decline in fertility in the United States is because those who are on lower incomes are not pairing up in a sort of stable situation and are not having as many children. And so that's surprising because, that's concerning to us because it does suggest that one of the reasons for why there is a decline in the fertility rate.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about increasing the birth rate in the U.S. with Chris Bullivant, Director of Communication for the Institute for Family Studies, which promotes pronatalism through its Pronatalism Initiative. So when the ideas that the Trump administration is considering hit the news, like the $5,000 baby bonus and the motherhood medal, reaction on social media was swift. Here is mother of four, Diana Harvey. She posted this video on TikTok, and you'll be able to hear her kids playing in the background.
I just feel like it's really just insulting. Like, if you want people to have more kids, make housing more affordable, make food more affordable. And I don't want to hear anyone saying that prices are going down, at least with food, because they're not. They're going up.
So your group supports some economic incentives to help build young families, expanding the child tax credit, for example. What does your group say to people who say that a tax credit and a $5,000 baby bonus, that's just not enough?
You know, family affordability is definitely like a real thing. And so there is a sense in which we have suggested that housing needs to be affordable, and there's a whole range of ideas that you can go about doing that. I think the biggest driver of family affordability crisis can be the idea of you know, we need to have dual income. And that's also, I think, it puts people off getting married. And the reason we bang on about that is only because it just has such a positive impact on the lives of those children and the lives of the adults who are involved in the family. And because people are able to then have the benefits of dual income. But during that period where you're experiencing a drop in income, for too many people, starting a family is just a financially catastrophic event. So that even the prospect of starting out with one child can be significantly difficult. That is especially the case for those in blue collar jobs who don't have things like advanced 2-week scheduling or a whole number of different things. There's a lot that the private sector can do to make work and family much more integrated and a much more enjoyable experience to be able to get family going. One of the solutions there could be a suggestion of paid family leave. I think the reason that we would perhaps fall down more on the child tax credit, you can probably tell from my accent, I've grown up in a country where there was paid family leave. Mm-hmm. You get 6 months off and you can have 12 months off with the child, and then both the employer and the government help pay for that. Does it, the UK also has a declining birth rate, fertility rate. What I think we have noticed is that it's a more American approach to provide choice. So parents want to have choice about how they go about raising their family and how they go about receiving their income. So I think on paid family leave, it can be a little bit too prescriptive about how you're meant to be organizing your family. You have to take some leave off. You have to, you may have to switch who the primary caregiver is in the situation. So there is a sense in which the child tax credit or lump sum approach, and then also similarly with childcare, we would be much more about plural choice, giving parents choice. So if they want to have grandparents or neighbours or their faith community helping with childcare, that should be an available option to them rather than just a sort of a more universal one-size-fits-all industrial daycare situation. We're very much about people who have able to fulfill their aspirations and then they get choice. And so it does seem that something more like the child tax credit model thing does allow for people to have make their own arrangements.
Yes, $5,000 only pays for maybe 2 months, 3 months, if you're lucky, of childcare. I can even speak for myself. You talked about having a dual income household. And if you want that choice, you want to be able to work and have a family. Having two children in daycare cost more than my salary. And so the idea of being able to be dual income and have a child in childcare is impossible for some people. I live in a different city than the grandparents who would not have been able to watch my child because all of the grandparents were still working. So, I just feel like it doesn't work for everyone. And maybe that's why we're having fewer kids.
Yeah, definitely family affordability. I think the Wall Street Journal came out with a figure that it was $300,000 to raise one child over the course of 0 to 18. So these are definitely real considerations. We do find, though, that when surveyed, the majority of women, which is to say, I believe just a little over a half, would prefer to be in part-time work. And this is for a period of time. Obviously, certainly during early infancy, where there is some more flexibility for being able to stay at home or to be able to work from home. But again, to have a childcare situation that is more integrated. So some people definitely want to be able to do dual income and then have childcare and sort of would be pro something that's like an extension of pre-K down through to universal childcare. And then others would suggest, well, if you have that extension down to childcare, why don't you have school choice around the childcare? So that actually, if you want that cash to go to a grandparent or a community, a collection of parents that you're familiar with, just to build that. Because I think one of the other things that is also driving the decline in marriage, and again, this is very much more down the lower income scale, isn't just about the finances. There's a disintegration of the village that is around people to support them in the raising of their children. So the reason that we're concerned about the decline of marriage rates too amongst the poor, amongst those on lower income rather, because it can be around the poor and those on low income, because it's around, for those who are in prime working age, the marriage rate for those who are under $50,000 a year is more, around 27%. So 27% of that income group will be married. That totally changes when you're looking at anything above 111,000, where 75% of the population are married. That is not an experience that was shared by anyone in the 1970s. In the 1970s, actually, you were more likely to be married if you had a high school education only than if you had been a college educated. There's been a huge decline in marriage rates, but there's also a massive opting out of work and a decline of other neighborly relationships, or what you could call social capital. So I think we should definitely be looking at the affordability, but some of the, this has been my experience, but some of the shrinkage around the village that supports people is also a huge factor in why they're reticent to be able to have children, because it's almost As your previous guest was saying, that not necessarily feeling emotionally prepared to do it.
If I'm listening to this and I'm a single mom, or I'm divorced, or if I'm in a same-sex marriage, I'm going to think that your institution doesn't care very much about me and my family, because you're definitely talking about the more traditional family. So what about that? Because America is full of choice, and it's full of people who are single moms and divorced and have same-sex marriages.
Yeah, I mean, the United States is like the leader in single parent families. We have the highest single parent family rate in the world, and so our emphasis on diversity. I mean, is that we see this actually in the schools in Ohio, that students in the schools in Ohio are very curious to know how life works and how relationships work. We've helped develop a curriculum around the success sequence, which is this idea that if you complete a high school education, if you manage to get a full-time job in your 20s, if you get married before you have a child, the people that do that, 97% of them are not in poverty. And so we look at wanting to promote that idea to students, because students are very keen to know how to make life work. So for example, if you decide to drop out of high school, you've just made a $500,000 decision. You're gonna lose $500,000 on your life course income by dropping out of high school compared to those who complete their high school diploma.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there because we are out of time, but I want to thank you. Yeah,
thank you.
I want to thank you for your time. That was Chris Bullivant, Director of Communications for the Institute of Family Studies, which promotes pronatalism. Thank you for your time today, Chris.
Thanks, Amy.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
The thing, artificial intelligence is just that, artificial.
You are just bombarded, particularly on social media, with images of people who look impossible, and often, you know, it's because it is impossible.
I'm Kai Rizdal, AI at Work, next time on Marketplace. This evening at 6 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from listeners. You can give at WOSU.org. Support also comes from Understory, a restaurant from the team at Wolf's Ridge Brewing, featuring live music, trivia, and other recurring events. More info at understorycbus.com.
This is WOSU-FM and HD1 Columbus, 89.7 NPR News. Global. Local. Access to a lawyer can be life-changing for thousands of Americans working their way through the legal system. In rural Ohio, lawyers are in short supply, leaving thousands of Ohioans with little in the way of legal aid or accessible help. This disparity is not marginal. In Franklin County, there's one lawyer for every 347 people, while in Madison County, the number is one lawyer for every 3,000 people. This can have devastating consequences, as the complexities of the legal system make navigating it without a lawyer incredibly difficult. Today on All Sides, we're talking about the lack of lawyers in rural Ohio, why there are so few of them, and what it means for those in need. That's after the news on All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News and at WOSU.org.
Live from NPR.